Lecture 3, The Dismal Science, Thomas Robert Malthus and David Ricardo.
Adam Smith not only founded the subject of economics in an intellectual sense, but his work, The Wealth of Nations, was much discussed and stimulated an enormous outpouring of work thinking about these relationships and these ideas that he had put forward. Two of the most prominent people who followed in the decades just after were Thomas Robert Malthus and David Ricardo, and those two men are the subject of this lecture. When you think of Thomas Robert Malthus, you should be thinking of someone born toward the end of the 18th century and living into the 19th. He was born 1766 and died in 1834. Malthus was the insider. He was the son of a lawyer who was friends with David Hume and with people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He was educated at Cambridge, did ministry in the Church of England. He became a professor of history and political economy. In fact, some people think he may have been the first one who officially had the title Professor of Political Economy. Ricardo, on the other hand, is the outsider. Again, we're talking the same time frame. Ricardo was born 1772, and lived until 1823. He was the son of Jewish immigrants who emigrated to England from Holland, as you may remember Bernard von Mandeville did. He had no formal schooling after the age of 14, but his father was a stockbroker, and he learned that trade. However, at age 21, he married a Quaker woman, converted to Unitarianism, was disinherited and disowned by his family, and had to enter business on his own, where he promptly made a fortune. Ricardo said that he made all of his money playing the stock market, and he used to say that he made his money on the overreactions of the stock market and by taking profits. He said whenever stock started going up, he'd buy it right away, hold it until there was a small profit, and then sell it off before it started dropping again. And conversely, if stocks were falling. So if stocks started falling, he'd sell right away, wait until it had fallen a little bit lower, and then buy it back at a cheaper price, and then wait for it to rise again. So these two men, this insider and this outsider, actually, oddly, were the best of friends, the most intimate of companions. Both the two men and their wives saw each other socially almost every weekend for years and years and years. They focused on each other, they thought about each other, and they talked about each other. And in some ways, the story of economics in the early 1800s is the story of the friendship between Malthus and Ricardo and the many, many, many disagreements that they had between the two of them. Let's begin by talking about Malthus and his view. Malthus is perhaps best known to us today because if you've ever heard someone say Malthusian projections, they're talking about the theories of Reverend Malthus. His most famous essay was called An Essay on the Principle of Population. And, of course, because it had a longer title than that, the subtitle was As It Affects the Future Improvement of Society with the Remarks on the Speculations of Mr. Godwin M. Condorcet and Other Writers. The title is understandably usually abbreviated nowadays to just Essay on the Principle of Population. But who were these guys, Godwin and Condorcet and other writers? For our purposes, what you really need to know is that they were some of the first utopian philosophers. Godwin in particular believed that it was possible to abolish war, to abolish want, that if people could learn to live in harmony with each other, we could manage to overcome all our difficulties, everyone could be well-to-do and live harmoniously with each other. Condorcet was one of the physiocrats who felt similarly, although he perhaps wasn't quite as optimistic as Godwin was. Malthus sets out in his essay on the principle of population to demolish this cheerful view. In fact, Malthus is one of the people who's often credited with having brought economics the reputation of being the dismal science, because he sets off after these cheerful utopians and proceeds just to beat them into the ground with merciless logic. He starts off by saying, look, the question here is not, would people be happy if the world was different? The question is, what's really going to happen here? He writes in his essay on the principle of population, a writer may tell me he thinks man will ultimately become an ostrich. I cannot properly contradict him. But before he can expect to bring any reasonable person over to his opinion, he ought to show that the necks of mankind have been gradually elongating, and the lips have grown harder and more prominent, and the legs and feet are daily altering their shape, and the hair is beginning to change into stubs of feathers. Until the probability of so wonderful a conversion can be shown, it is surely lost lost time and lost eloquence to expatiate on the happiness of man in such a state, to describe his powers of running and flying, and to paint him in a condition where all narrow luxuries would be condemned, where he would be employed only in collecting the necessaries of life, and where each man's share of labor would be light and his portion of leisure ample. You know? I think his choice of the ostrich was, of course, metaphorical, that he thought the socialists were sticking their heads in the ground, and they were just not paying sense to what was really going on in the world. So, what's really going on? He all starts off with two what he calls postulata, postulates. I think I may fairly make two postulata. First, that food is necessary to the existence of man. Second, that the passion between the sexes is necessary and will remain nearly in its present state. These two laws, ever since we have had any knowledge of mankind, appear to have been fixed laws of our nature. And as we have not hitherto seen any alteration in them, we have no right to conclude they will ever cease to be what they are now. So, we're starting off with the basic notion, with these two basic ideas. Now, why does that get us into trouble? How does that lead to a conclusion that's difficult? Well, he says that population and food supply are going to grow at different rates. In particular, he says, assuming then my postulata as granted, I say that the power of population is indefinitely greater than the power in the earth to produce subsistence for man. Why is that? Population, when unchecked, increases in a geometrical ratio. Subsistence increases only in an arithmetical ratio. A slight acquaintance with numbers will show the immensity of the first power in comparison with the second. Now, we need a slight acquaintance with numbers here. What does he mean by this geometrical, arithmetical thing? What he's saying is that when food supply increases, it will increase like the multiplication table. It will go times 2, times 3, times 4. That's an arithmetical progression, counting up, if you will. Geometrical, on the other hand, is to the power of whatever. So population will square in size, square again in size, square again in size. So think about two different sets of numbers. One is just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's arithmetic growth. Now think about doubling and doubling. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. The geometrical power of doubling over time increases much more rapidly a few years into the future than the arithmetic pattern of increasing one step at a time. So, if population doubles and doubles and doubles, but food increases only one step at a time, it will inevitably be true that there won't be enough food for folks, that the world will run out of food. Now, he offers several kind of back-of-the-envelope estimates of how he thinks this is going to work. He suggests that over a period of 25 years, if you look at a place like America at that time, that the population can double every 25 years. He suggests that the amount of food could perhaps double in the first 25 years, but then it will just keep increasing by the same amount every 25-year period after that. It won't double again and double again. It will just increase like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And so he writes in his essay on population, "Let us take, as the result of actual experience, we will take as our rule and say that population, when unchecked, goes on doubling itself every 25 years. That is, it increases in a geometrical ratio." Then he talks about food and how that can be grown. And he says, in the next 25 years, it is impossible to suppose that produce could be quadrupled. It would be contrary to all our knowledge of the qualities of land. The very utmost we can conceive is the increase in the second 25 years might equal present produce. Let us then take it for our rule, though certainly far from the truth, and allow that by great exertion, the whole produce of the island might be increased every 25 years by a quantity of subsistence equal to that what it at present produces. The most enthusiastic spectator cannot suppose a greater increase than this. In a few centuries, it would make every acre of the land in the island like a garden. Yet this rate of increase is arithmetical. So, we've got a difficulty. Our geometrical growth is going to outstrip our arithmetical growth. We're going to end up with mass starvation. And those are laws of nature that come out of his postulata. Well, what are we going to do about this? What's going to happen in the world? Well, Malthus, being a good minister, says he can only see of several different outcomes. One is misery, one is vice, and another is that mankind learns to practice moral restraint, meaning not having quite so many kids. Now, how likely are these things to happen? Malthus, being a reverend and being a skeptic, wasn't all that confident that we would learn to practice moral restraint. And so he believed that famine and vice and death were the likely outcome as soon as maybe 50 or 75 years into the future. So, for example, he writes in his principal essay on population, "Famine seems to be the most dreadful resource of nature. The power of population is so superior to the power in the earth to produce subsistence for man that premature death must in some shape or other visit the human race. The vices of mankind are active and able ministers of depopulation. They are the precursors in the great army of destruction, and often finish the dreadful work themselves. But should they fail in this war of extermination, sickly seasons, epidemics, pestilence and plague advance in terrific array and sweep off their thousands and ten thousands. Should success still be incomplete, giant inevitable famine stalks in the rear, and with one mighty blow levels the population with the food of the world." Malthus was not a cheerful sort of man. What are the vices that he's talking about here? A lot of the vices are things like prostitution, or in his world, birth control, being things where we could avoid the increase in population by going to prostitutes and having birth control, but that would be such a vice that it would be something that he would not want to recommend. So, for example, in writing about birth control, Malthus wrote, "Indeed, I should always particularly reprobate any artificial and unnatural modes of checking population, both on account of their immorality and their tendency to remove a stimulus necessary to industry," which is an interesting thought. "If it were possible for each married couple to limit by a wish the number of their children, there is certainly reason to fear that the indolence of the human race would be very greatly increased, and that neither the population of individual countries nor the whole earth would ever reach its natural and proper extent. If people didn't have kids, they wouldn't want to work. After all, the only reason people work is to go out there and support their children. If they were able to limit the number of their children by using the sinful method of birth control, then they wouldn't work so hard. The society wouldn't grow. There wouldn't be an expansion of the economy." Clearly, this is a point where, in modern terms, we need to think about it a little bit more closely. What are the preventive checks that Malthus is talking about? The moral restraint. His notion was, marry late. Wait until you can support kids. Don't have kids until you can support them. He argues that people do often put off marriage because they're worried that it might affect their standard of living. He writes, "The preventive check appears to operate in some degree in all ranks of society in England. There are some men who are prevented from marrying by the idea of the expenses they must retrench and the pleasures they must deprive themselves of on the supposition of having a family. These considerations undoubtedly prevent a great number in this rank of life from following the bent of their inclinations in an early attachment. Others, guided either by a stronger passion or a weaker judgment, break through these restraints. And it would be hard indeed if the gratification of so delightful a passion as virtuous love did not sometimes more than counterbalance all its attendant evils." You know, we're going to have virtuous love, but that's going to mean kids. And kids is going to lead toward mass death. Just so you know, Malthus thought that probably the only way out of this was to try and educate the poor. And so he continued with Smith's tradition that public education was a way out of this trap. He says, "In most countries among the lower people, there appears to be something like a standard of wretchedness, a point below which they will not continue to marry and propagate their species. In an attempt to better the condition of the laboring classes of society, our object should be to raise this standard as high as possible by cultivating a spirit of independence, a decent pride, a taste for cleanliness and comfort. The effect of a good government in increasing the prudential habits and personal respectability of the lower classes of society has already been insisted on. But this effect will always be incomplete without a good system of education. Indeed, it may be said that no government can approach to perfection that does not provide for the instruction of the people." And so he was willing to sort of promote this moral restraint, this notion that you shouldn't just breed and have kids right away in an active sort of way, although not to advocate birth control or something like that. So I'm not quite sure where that puts him on the modern spectrum of thinking about these issues.
Malthus, just so you know about his own personal life, did not marry until age 39. He did have 3 children, but no grandchildren. And I always sort of think there must be a good Freudian story there of being preached at by your father about not having children, and somehow comforting that Malthus had no grandchildren to me. A lot of his language does have this old-time minister sound. And remember, he is a minister. You know, he's a Church of England minister, and that's how he's trained. There's no escaping this problem by having government relief for the poor. Government relief for the poor is only going to encourage the poor to have more kids and hasten the problem that we're trying to prevent. He wrote about the poor laws, which were the welfare laws of that time, and said, "It is a subject often started in conversation and mentioned always as a matter of great surprise that notwithstanding the immense sum that is annually collected for the poor in England, there is still so much distress among them. Some think the money must be embezzled. Others that the churchwardens and overseers must consume the greater part of it in dinners. All agree that somehow or other it must be very ill-managed." When you think about modern complaints about money going to the poor, we spend so much. How do those people stay so poor? It must be that it's very ill-managed. But Malthus says, "But a man who sees a little below the surface of things would be very much more astonished if the fact were otherwise than it is observed to be. The poor laws of England were undoubtedly instituted for a most benevolent purpose, but there is great reason to think they have not succeeded in their intention. They certainly mitigate some cases of very severe distress. Yet, as he goes on, I feel little doubt in my own mind that if the poor laws had never existed, though there might have been a few more instances of severe distress, yet the aggregate mass of happiness among the common people would be much greater than it is at present." His argument was, if you give poor people money, they're just going to have more kids. If they have more kids, we all hit famine sooner. We should educate people, try and practice moral restraint. But this business of trying to help people in that way just brings us all closer to disaster more quickly than we otherwise would. He writes, "To remove the wants of the lower class of society is indeed an arduous task. The truth is that the pressure of distress on this part of a community is an evil so deeply seated that no human ingenuity can reach it. Were I to propose a palliative, and palliatives are all the nature of the case will admit, it should be in the first place the total abolition of all the present poor laws." He also says, later on, that he would be glad to have encouraged people to find new land where they could start up farms. He says he's willing to set up county workhouses where people would go and be put into the workhouse and have jobs. So in our modern terms, you would say Malthus was a supporter of workfare. He believed you should not just give people money. He believed that you had to force them into jobs on the farm or in county workhouses. And in that sense, the arguments over welfare that we have in the 1990s are very similar to the arguments over the poor laws that Malthus was confronting at that time. How has the Malthusian thesis held up? How has this idea of increasing population held up over time? Well, one thing that Malthus doesn't really take into account, which sort of makes sense he wouldn't take into account, is the growth of new technology and innovation. Because remember, writing in 1798, there's not a whole lot of new technology and innovation to be writing about. There's some, but you can't blame him for perhaps not seeing it all clearly. If you think about this notion, if you look at the raw data, you can see that population has been increasing over time. Population in 1850 for the world was about 1 billion. It's up to about 5 billion today. If you work that out to an annual rate, you find that population over this time has been increasing about 1.2% a year. Our population has been increasing 1.2% a year. The odd thing is, of course, given that people are so much richer now, on average, than they were in 1850, that output has continued to increase considerably more rapidly than that. And while it's hard to get good measures of world output in 1850, given the state of statistics, we've probably been growing a percent or two faster in overall output every year since then. So on the most fundamental thing, does population outstrip food and cause famine? Malthus was expecting this to happen in the mid to late 1800s. You would have to say, no, it hasn't happened. I mean, sure, there have been localized famines, but the whole world has not been wiped out as he was predicting in that way. A second thing Malthus overlooked clearly was changes in social customs and attitudes about things like birth control. Ideas about morality change, the notion that birth control is possible and people might make different choices as they become more wealthy. They might say, look, you know, these kids are kind of a nuisance, you know. I want to get started in my career first and have some work and get some work experience under my belt and not just have a whole bunch of kids. And those changes in social attitudes are things that are clearly not taken account in Malthus's view. A third thing that he doesn't really take into account is the interaction between economic growth and the birth rate. It's been often pointed out that one of the reasons people in poor countries have kids is that the kids are a way of supporting their own standard of living. For example, if you have a lot of kids in a poor country, they're labor for the farm. And if it's a country that doesn't have a social security system, they can support you after your death. So the kids are economically important to you in a direct way. In a rich country, our children don't, you know, work on our farms. Instead, we have to pay to put them through school and different things like that, and buy them clothes, send them to summer camp. We have social security later on in life. And so the economic reasons for children are not as big as they once were. One way of putting it that economists use in our typical blunt language is to say, kids used to be an investment. They paid a return to you. Now kids are a consumption good. You have them because it's pleasant to have them around. And that shift from an investment to a consumption good for children is a big social change that Malthus didn't really see. Finally, Malthus clearly was ahead of his time in thinking about the modern argument over how we assist the poor. Helping the poor is, of course, still every bit as controversial today. We are having the same arguments about work requirements, although most people aren't in favor of workhouses anymore. And you still hear people saying the best thing we could do for welfare would be to abolish it, because after all, you know, sure it'll cause some short-term pain, but over time it'll be the one thing that really helps if we assured everybody a job. The irony over all this kind of makes me smile. If you think about Malthus's population beliefs, he's really sort of a forefather of the strong environmentalist left in modern politics. But if you think about his welfare beliefs, he's clearly a forefather of kind of the conservative right. And it's interesting how in older times, views that we might now think to be fairly dissimilar come together without a lot of difficulty. Before talking more about Malthus, let's skip over and talk about David Ricardo. Ricardo first read The Wealth of Nations around about 1800. He's working as a stockbroker at the time, and he begins to think about the subject in general. His first published work is a letter to the newspaper, which is about currency problems of that time. And it's a problem which has come down to us in modern times as the bullion controversy. And it's worth a quick mention here. In the early 1800s, toward the end of the Napoleonic Wars, there's high inflation in Britain. The big reason seems to be that the Bank of England runs out of gold, and they stop using gold to exchange for their notes because they just don't have any gold left at the end of the war after paying the soldiers and having trade disrupted. What happens then is that the Bank of England, as well as many rural banks, just begin issuing banknotes. They're not linked to gold anymore, so they just print money and send it out there. And from a modern point of view, it's not a big shock that if you're just printing money and pumping it out into the economy, what you expect to get is a reasonable amount of inflation. Prices start rising. But at the time, the mechanics of inflation are not well understood. And so there's an enormous controversy over what's the cause of this inflation that's happening. Ricardo's answer is, we're having inflation because we're printing a lot of money. And he gives essentially the modern answer. The countervailing argument, to give you a sense of how economics arguments are still being conducted at the time, is that we're having inflation because, you know, things are getting more expensive. Now, if that seems like a bit of a circular argument or an argument that doesn't really explain anything, you've got the point. People are not thinking very clearly about what these terms and ideas mean. And so the notion that, you know, we have inflation because gold's more expensive and everything's more expensive is kind of like saying we have inflation because we have inflation. And Ricardo is trying to explain that, no, the inflation has a cause. It's from the printing of all the money that's been happening. He proposed and said, look, we don't have to keep trading money for gold. What we need to do is just regulate our currency properly as if we were regulating it according to gold. And if we regulate our currency properly, we can make this work out. In his Principles of Political Economy, written in 1817, Ricardo writes, on these principles, it will be seen it is not necessary that Paper money should be payable in gold specie to secure its value. It is only necessary that the quantity of paper money should be regulated according to the value of the metal, which is declared to be the standard. Now, that's a little bit confusing to our modern ear, but his sense is that, look, you can just regulate the amount of money, the paper money that's out there. You don't have to worry about trading back and forth for gold. In terms of modern monetary policy, that's what we do. We try and regulate the amount of money in such a way as to make sure that inflation doesn't get too high and unemployment doesn't get out of control. The basic problem that Ricardo tackles in his classic book, Principles of Political Economy, is to work through in a careful and cautious way the distribution of income throughout the society. Again, he takes the three groups, landlords, manufacturers, and workers, and he says we've got three ways they get money. Landlords get rent, manufacturers get profits, and workers get wages. So with these three groups, we're now going to talk about how do they get their money and how is it determined. You can think of it in a way as taking the tableau économique and looking at it in a really straightforward kind of way. Well, one at a time, how does this work? Where does the rent come from for landlords? Well, his notion is, imagine there's a group of landlords. Some own very good land, some own really lousy land. When they all go off and grow food on that land, the landlord with good land is going to be able to grow a lot more because they have good soil or good irrigation and those kinds of things. So, working on the good land is going to produce a lot more food than working on the bad land is going to produce. And as a result, the landlord who owns the good land is going to make more money. So what landlords are trying to do is make money by owning good land. Now, as the population expands, we keep expanding out to worse and worse land. And so the people who own the good land do better and better and better as we expand out and produce food on worse and worse land. What about wages for workers? Well, he argues that wages have a natural price. And the natural price is how much does it cost to keep a worker alive? And that will tend to be the natural price of producing labor. So in terms of a cost of production idea, that sort of Adam Smith idea, wages will be set according to what people need to get to stay alive. And given the habits and customs of people, that's just going to be how wages are determined. He argued, however, that he didn't quite think we were going to go all the way to Malthusian starvation, because he believed that before that happened, people would back off on having kids. So he believed you could have sort of a moderate standard of living, and that subsistence level might rise with habits and customs over time. And finally, the third thing in terms of profits, the profits are going to tend to equalize over time. Because after all, if you're making a lot of profit in some area, then lots of people flood into that area, produce a lot more, and the profit eventually disappears. So in this sort of a model, you can see that the landlords are really the ones who have it best. The workers are getting their wages pushed down to subsistence. The manufacturers who get profits are competing with each other, so their profits eventually dissipate. But the landlords just keep getting more and more money as we expand society and we go out to worse and worse kinds of land. Now, that theory as I describe it doesn't sound exciting to me. It probably doesn't sound that exciting to you. But it is a really systematic attempt to work through each of these different areas of society, how they get their money, and what the interrelationships are between those. And it describes, in some sense, Malthus's mindset, that he's just a very painstaking, very careful guy looking at all of these things. Now, I've said a couple of times that Malthus and Ricardo disagreed with each other, but I haven't yet mentioned those disagreements. So let's talk about the great disagreements between Malthus and Ricardo and their relationship between the two of them. They met in 1811 when Malthus responded to Ricardo's piece about bullion and suggested that they meet. In his letter, Malthus wrote, "As we are mainly on the same side of the question, we might supersede the necessity of a long controversy in print respecting the points on which we differ by an amicable discussion in private." Let's not fight in print. Let's talk it over. And their discussions went on for 12 years until Ricardo's death. What were the three main disagreements that they had over that time? One is an argument which has come down to us today as an argument over gluts. And by gluts, we mean what we would call today recession. Lots of stuff being produced and not enough buying power to soak it all up. Now, what were the two competing theories of gluts at that time? A French economist named Jean-Baptiste Say had formulated what's known as Say's Law. And Say's Law was the notion that, to put it in a very quick sentence, supply creates its own demand. What's that mean? It means when you produce something and sell it, then you have a certain buying power. You have the buying power you got from selling the product. So anytime you supply something, there is also buying power created in an equal amount. In that theory, supply and demand must always be equal to each other. They must always balance out. So, Ricardo, who is a supporter of Say's law, writes, M. Say has, however, most satisfactorily shown there is no amount of capital which may not be employed in a country. No man produces but with a view to consume or sell. And you never sell but with an intention to purchase some other commodity, which may be immediately useful or which may contribute to future production. By producing, then, a man necessarily becomes either the consumer of his own goods or the purchaser and consumer of the goods of some other person. Supply creates its own demand. Malthus didn't see it. In Malthus's argument, the problem was that rich people were going to be producing all this stuff, but they weren't going to consume it all. They were going to save way too much of it. Because after all, they were so rich, they just couldn't afford to consume all of it. They liked to build up their fortune, they wanted to hoard a lot of money. And so, in his view, there would be a lot of production, but rich people would not be consuming in equal amount. For them, supply would not be creating enough demand, and there would be a glut or a surplus formed as a result. Malthus also wrote A Principles of Political Economy in about 1820, which you have to read kind of as a response to Ricardo because they were so intimately linked together. He argued that what was really important to do was to have people who would do what he called unproductive consumption, like having a war or something like that, so that you could pump up the amount of demand that was in the economy and make sure that everything that was produced would also be consumed. He writes, capitalists certainly have the power of consuming their profits. And if they were to consume it, with the exception of what could be beneficially added to their capital so as to provide in the best way for an increased production in the future, there might be little occasion for unproductive consumers. But such consumption is not consistent with the actual habits of most capitalists. The great object of their lives is to save a fortune. If they're going to be saving all this, then they're not consuming. He says it has been laid down as a sort of axiom among some writers that the wants of mankind may be considered at all times commensurate with their powers. But this position is not always true, even in those cases where a fortune comes without trouble. And in the reference to the great mass of capitalists, it is completely contradicted by experience. Almost all merchants and manufacturers save in prosperous times much more rapidly than it would be possible for the national capital to increase. They save so much they can't possibly invest it all. There must therefore, Malthus argued, be a considerable class of persons who have both the will and the power to consume more material wealth than they produce. Or the mercantile classes could not continue to produce so much more than they consume. In this class, the landlords are no doubt preeminent. And so he's sort of thinking, the problem with the capitalists is they're going to produce all this stuff and not consume it. Well, how can we get enough consumption? Let's go over to the landlords. After all, they're completely unproductive. All they do is sit around and collect rent. But they serve an economic function for Malthus, which is trying to make sure that there would be enough consumption in the society as a whole. Now, this dispute has come down to us in modern times. We'll be talking about it again in lectures 9 and 10 of this series. Fundamentally, it is, does an economy come toward a balance where supply and demand are equal to each other, or can an economy get in situations where there's big surpluses, big gluts? And when there are big gluts, there will tend to be unemployed people. If there are these unemployed people, does the economy get rid of those people because supply eventually creates its own demand, or does it not get rid of that? And as a result, can end up with a situation where you could have a recession for a long period of time. Malthus and Ricardo raised this argument, argued over it for a decade, and frankly, neither of them could figure out what the other one was saying. They just kept repeating back and forth to each other without ever quite being able to settle it. What's their second argument? Second argument for the two of them is over the corn laws. The corn laws are laws affecting whether or not Britain would import corn from Europe. For a few hundred years, there have been various corn laws in effect. The notion of the corn laws was to make sure that British farmers got a high price for corn. So what that meant was, if the price ever got too low, then they would shut out corn from Europe. And by shutting out corn from Europe, they would manage to jack up the price for British farmers again. Now, in the decade or so around 1800, it's the Napoleonic Wars. Over in Europe, they're not producing very much of anything. And so prices, farm prices are high in Britain. The corn laws are no big issue. But by about 1815, the Napoleonic Wars are over. Europe is producing a lot more grain. They're shipping a lot of it to Britain. Farm prices are going down and down and down. Question, should we shut out that corn, those imports, and make sure that we keep the price high for farmers? Well, Malthus was in favor of doing that, of shutting out the imports, of enforcing the corn laws. He was afraid that Britain would become reliant on France for corn. He said, manufacturing is growing rapidly. It's important that agriculture grow just as fast as manufacturing. And if agriculture needs this little boost to keep up, then that's how it ought to be. He said, we need to keep the corn laws because we need to keep prices high so the landlords make a lot of money. Because we need the landlords to make a lot of money so they can do all the unproductive consumption to avoid gluts building up like they're otherwise going to build up. So he believed that it was important to generate that high price for farmers. Ricardo, on the other hand, said that the corn laws were a bad idea. He said, remember, that the wages of workers were going to be determined by what it cost to feed them. What that means is if the price of corn is low, then wages will also be low. Because that's what the cost of feeding people is. If the price of corn is high, then wages will also be high. So Ricardo's notion was, keep the price of corn low, keep wages low, because that's what encourages capitalists to keep investing and accumulating new equipment, and generally will improve the state of society over time. This argument, frankly, in modern terms, they both were somewhat confused about what was going on. For our modern purposes, the most interesting part of the argument, I believe, is that in thinking about the corn laws, David Ricardo developed a theory that we now call the theory of comparative advantage. And it's the theory of trade which really governs how economists think about trade to this very day. Remember that up until now, when we talked about trade, a lot of the time we were emphasizing the kind of trade that came out of a natural benefit, like England producing wool because it's a good climate for sheep, Portugal producing wine because it's a good climate for grapes, Italy having finance because it's a good center for shipping, those kinds of natural things. What Ricardo described was a situation where things could be good, even though where trade could be beneficial to both sides, even if one side was more efficient at producing all the goods. Now, this is a counterintuitive idea. The best way to tackle it, I think, is to think about a metaphor. And the one that I think about sometimes is, I think about my family going on a camping trip when I was a little boy. Now, of all the things that need to happen on a camping trip, collecting firewood, setting up tents, catching fish, cooking dinner, cleaning up, all those kinds of things, my father is the best one at all of them in the family. Question then. Does it make sense for all the rest of us just to sit around and let Dad do everything because he's the best at it? Answer, of course not. That would be silly. What you want to do instead is find a task for each person where even if I'm not as good at collecting firewood as my dad, you can still send me out into the woods and I'll bring some back, and that benefits the group as a whole. So the task is not to think about who's best at everything, but to think about what's the comparative advantage, what's the best contribution that everybody can make. The same is true of the global economy. Instead of thinking about which country is best at everything, and then saying you should only do it if you're best, what you want to do is think about what contribution is everyone best suited to make. And just as on those camping trips, having everyone work and share some of the burdens made for everyone being better off, it's going to be true for the global economy, that if all nations do what they can best do, even if they're not absolutely the best at it, the world economy as a whole will be better off. A third argument between Malthus and Ricardo was an argument over value and price. And this just goes back to the same arguments they were having with the mercantilists, goes back to the same arguments they were having with Smith. Now, how do we measure value and price? What's the yardstick that we're going to use? Sometimes Malthus argued for a labor theory of value. Sometimes banker David Ricardo said, well, I don't like the labor theory of value because there's so many different kinds of labor. But what I like is a gold theory of value. I think we should just measure everything in terms of gold. And he argued, well, gold is produced by labor and by capital, and so let's use gold as our standard for measuring everything. There are times when Malthus writes things which seem to be, if you read them, almost like a description of supply and demand, as we think about those terms today. For example, Malthus wrote, "It may be said that the permanent prices of the great mass of commodities will be determined by the ordinary cost of their production." Remember, that's Smith's cost of production theory. He says, "This is unquestionably true if we include all the parts of the price, as stated by Adam Smith. Even here, however, our familiar experience shows us that any alteration in the proportion of the demand to the supply quite overcomes for a time the influence of these costs. And further, when we come to examine the subject more closely, we find the cost of production itself only influences the price of these commodities. As the payment of this cost is the necessary condition of their continued supply in proportion to the extent of the effectual demand for them. But if this should be true, it follows that the great law of demand and supply is called into action to determine what Adam Smith calls natural prices, as well as what he calls market prices." Now, my point here is not to say that Malthus invented supply and demand. It's just to say that these folks are all shuffling back and forth with these categories. Some demand, some supply, some labor, some gold. You know, are things useful? Are they not useful? And the use of terms is, frankly, just inconsistent throughout their writing. So they're still sort of struggling for some kind of a framework where that will all make sense. When I think back on Malthus and Ricardo, what you really need to think of them as prototypes of intellectual styles, in a way. Ricardo was the guy who wrote down theorems and examples and very carefully constructed numerical ideas. You may have noticed that in this lecture, I don't quote Ricardo very much. That's not coincidental. Ricardo is brutal to read, just very, very difficult to read. The Principles of Political Economy is badly organized. It doesn't have any nice anecdotes or examples. It's badly arranged. It's very theoretical. It's all focused on very picky little disagreements with Smith. In a way, if you think of Ricardo, you really need to think of the academic who just focuses on every little nitpicking point and makes sure he understands it 100% all the time. When you think about someone like Malthus, what you should be thinking about is a person who, you know, was in his way a preacher. You know, he saw the population things all going to pieces, you know, and he didn't see anything that could fix it. He thought we shouldn't be dependent on France, and he worried about sort of the political economy of, you know, what would happen if we became dependent on other countries. And so he was a much more sort of inductive, broad kind of thinker. And a lot of the difference between the two of them probably comes down to those differing intellectual styles, that Ricardo would offer these very focused, specific explanations, and Malthus would say, "I just don't see it. It seems to me like you could have gluts. I mean, I think there are gluts. I see gluts. You know, I mean, I just don't see your particular theory." And Ricardo would say, "This is the theory." And Malthus would say, "I just don't see it." So they went back and forth and back and forth. They wrote dozens of letters, many of which you can still read today. In 1823, Ricardo was beginning to suffer from a brain abscess, which would eventually kill him, and he wrote a final letter to Malthus. The conclusion of his letter was, "And now, my dear Malthus, I have done. Like other disputants, after much discussion, we each retain our own opinions. These discussions, however, never influence our friendship. I could not like you more than if you agreed in opinion with me. Pray give Mrs. Ricardo's and my kind regards to Mrs. Malthus, yours truly." Ricardo died 2 weeks later. At his funeral, Malthus said, "I never loved anybody out of my own family so much. Our interchange of opinions was so unreserved, and the object after which we were both inquiring was so nearly the truth and nothing else, that I cannot but think that we sooner or later must have agreed." And after 12 years of argument. In a more recent reflection on their friendship, the Harvard economist Robert Dorfman described it this way. He said, "It is as though each served as the anvil for the other's hammer, and their ideas were hammered out in their efforts to persuade each other. I cannot help dissenting from Malthus's affectionate and hopeful remark at the funeral. I believe that if there is a corner in heaven where good economists go, they are there to this very day, getting no closer to agreement about the meaning and proper measurement of value." As someone who spends most of his life arguing with contentious economists, I think that the model of agreement and friendship between two people who have different styles and disagree so fully is something that we can take away and work with ourselves.